So it's lunchtime here at In Situ 2024. Huge crowd of architects sitting outside Spark. The black clothing sucking the light out of a otherwise beautiful Auckland day. Friend of the pod and award-winning architect Mike Hartley of Lloyd Hartley here. Mike, what have you enjoyed about the day so far?
Hello, Arch. Thank you for talking to me. It's super exciting. It's always lovely to come along to In Situ, mainly just to put your head above the parapet and see what's going on out there in the world. I think it's been expertly adjudicated, managed, corralled by
Ollie Wainwright.
Correct.
Yes, he wandered into one of our recordings asking if there was a toilet. So that's a strange
good
cameo.
Start. Good start. But I think he's been marshalling the troops rather well, and it's lovely to hear his kind of critique early on and sort of strategies. And then from there on in, it's just been lovely to see people that are really kind of pushing boundaries. And
the boundaries didn't get pushed much further than by Junya Ishigami.
Well, yeah, right? Like, just dig a hole, fill it with concrete, and then what's left over is right there.
Well, you know, someone I was talking to yesterday said one of the things about today is you leave equal parts inspired and depressed.
Oh, that's an interesting takeaway. I've never found that.
I've always depressed?
No, completely the opposite. Thanks, Matt. Always felt kind of uplifted. Again, that kind of popping your head over the parapet and daring to dream. Of course, all the projects that we're seeing today aren't every project that they've ever done. And I think that's important to remember.
Thanks very much for being put on the spot, Mike. Thank you.
Pleasure. Cheers, team.
Kia ora and welcome to 76 Small Rooms, a podcast about architecture from Aotearoa, New Zealand. This is episode 50.
Woohoo! Happy birthday.
This is our second interview today from New Zealand Institute of Architects In Situ 2024. And we are really lucky to be joined today by Sandra Barclay and Jean-Pierre Krauss of Barclay & Krauss. Thank you very much for joining us today and making time. Thank you for your talk earlier, which we've just come from. Absolutely fantastic, and a lot we're going to try and get into 20-30 minutes of talking with you both today. I wonder if I can ask you to just begin by introducing yourselves, please.
I'm Sandra Barclay, and I'm Peruvian. I studied in Peru, studied in Paris Belleville also, then went to stay in France 16 years, come back to Peru 2006. And then we worked together since 94. And we are married also twice.
We're partners, double partners. Yeah, I'm Jean-Pierre. I was also born in Lima, trained in Lima, then in Milan, and we had all this experience in Paris before coming back to Peru, and that's it. It's like we had this double adventure. No, first of all, going to Europe to see what happened, and then coming back. Many years after. No?
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations on 30 years of practice.
Yes, that's fantastic. Yes.
I'd like to start, I think it'd be great to talk about obviously some of the work, but very interested in process. I mean, some of the slides you showed today hinted at how you might work and also how you work as a partnership. The other speakers today are all individuals in their practices, but just to kind of begin with the work, a lot of the work we saw today and the work that is published and known has what I think is a very strongly monumental quality to it. It asserts itself quite strongly in the landscape. But on the other hand, it's extremely humane. And I'm interested in how you work from that scale, that weight and heft, down to the human and that sort of scale, mm-hmm. that scale shift. Also in that humane way. Because mm-hmm. it does feel soft mm-hmm. and gentle from an experiential point mm-hmm. of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe the key is in this experiential word, mm-hmm. because it's not, we are never thinking of architecture as an object or as something that it arrives on a site or imposed itself. but more about an experience, so more from the inside to the outside. So even when we design, I think we like the question of a facade or of an exterior of a form is not in our conversation. It will come like a consequence, not like of this interior space strategies on sections and intimacy, relation with the landscape or relation between the spaces. Also,
yeah, because maybe it comes from the interior, but it is not only an interpretation of a program, but also as a creation of a microcosm that is related to the larger scale of the territory, the landscape, and in that sense, is not an object, because we are thinking more about relations, human relations to landscape, relation to what is pre-existent there, than creating objects. No? Mm-hmm. So we're more concerned about creating meanings than objects. And maybe coming back to the question on how we work together, because we're two, is important to say that we are not, from the beginning, we didn't want to split the work. So there's no Sandra's
your projects.
They are all, and we don't feel more authors than the other. And to do that, we establish a conversation, because each one of you, of us, have obsessions. Not like every architect, it's formal obsessions. It's the background where we come from. The training, etc. So, in order to avoid that, we establish a conversation about what is meaningful for that particular project. Mm-hmm. Okay, and then when without any drawing or model, nothing. So we are only a verbal exchange. Until we reach some agreements, and then we split, and it's not a formula, but usually Sandra does models, little models, and I draw sketches, and then we come back and see whether the sketches or the models are more accurate in relationship to this idea. Mm-hmm. Or they question the idea and they find something better, or whatever. So it starts going back and forth, an iteration on how this microcosm that we want to create resonates with all these ideas.
So it's a process of like coming together and going apart and coming back together.
Yeah.
And as you're working through that, you say you begin with a conversation and establishing what are the important meanings or the, you know, whatever, but a design principle or a central idea. When you go away and come back together, it sounds like what you're doing is modifying and improving that idea rather than your sketches or models.
Yeah.
So you're continuing to go back to that thinking that's at the middle. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the model might be wrong, like that's not it. Or the model might raise a question you hadn't thought, and you'll build and improve. And then you've, in theory, got a perfect model or an optimal model. Mm-hmm. Where from there to the next kind of stages?
Yeah, we continue doing that, because there are several ways to test these ideas. It's not only the little handmade model and not only the sketch. Then it goes to the to the our collaborators in the office. They do 3D models or plans, and we come back to hand drawings, and so it's an iteration about several ways of
Reinforcing the ideas, no?
Because, or strengthening. Or
yes,
strengthening. Yeah. And sometimes we go apart from those ideas and then get back because we felt we are losing things.
Yeah.
And like, yeah. It depends in each.
That experiential way of thinking, I think, is very obvious in the way you spoke. Like, I made notes about this. Particularly a sequential experience, mm-hmm. not just an experience on its own, but you talk about, was it the UEDP, you have the light filterings and ramps, and you said, you know, the ramps slow you down, mm-hmm. and they let your eyes adjust mm-hmm. to the interior spaces. Uh-huh. That's a very deliberate, not just an experience, but an order mm-hmm. of experience. I think that's quite rare to hear people talk about architecture this way. It used to be much more common. It was very much how Frank Lloyd Wright would do it, or Leon Krier mm-hmm. would talk about things happening in order. Mm-hmm. Is that how it, you know, is that kind of how your process is? Mm-hmm. It's about those, mm-hmm.
yeah,
not just the experience, mm-hmm. but the order in which they happen.
Like, I think maybe...
Like a piece of music, almost.
Yes. Yeah. And also, maybe we are influenced by the Promenade Architecturale of Le Corbusier.
Right.
No, because yeah. we are, I think those moments of when you move, understanding what's happening around you in the building is very important. No? Like, you are working for establishing connections, and so this, yeah, thinking about those ways of filling the space and moving in the space.
Yeah. But maybe what is different mm-hmm. from the Promenade Architecturale is that we're trying always not to perceive the building given only one way mm. to see mm-hmm. it.
Yeah.
Okay, so even for private houses, there's no way to live, there's no one way to get in. So we want to open, it's like an open system where movement inside this hole is possible, but in different ways.
There's lots of combinations, yeah. different yeah. orders. Yeah.
So we're not trying to suggest only one mm. way to uh-huh. see the building.
Mm-hmm. No? Uh-huh.
And that's important, I think.
I'm interested in how you speak to your clients about this. Is that... you talk about a series of spatial sequences and moving through the building. Mm-hmm. Do you talk about it in that way, or is that something which is in your mind, but actually you talk to your client much yeah. more about the
yeah.
program?
It depends. It depends
yeah.
on the client.
Also.
because you have to convince the client to do certain things that, because when a client arrives, either private for a house or an institution, they have a something in mind already, and we establish with them always and again a conversation.
Yeah.
So we ask them to tell us what are their aspirations. Mm.
Or dreams about
what they are asking for, mm-hmm. in order to cut the images they have about their buildings
and then,
without yeah. knowing what mm-hmm. they really want. So we're trying to dismantle a frozen image
mm-hmm.
to really know what their aspirations mm-hmm. are really. And then there's a lot of conversation about our ideas in what they can understand. For instance, all these different promenades is a way of telling them, okay, you know, this house is for kids, but also for parents, and they can live together without being one on top of the other. So this gets more diversity. But I think maybe you can compliment me. The most difficult thing with clients is breaking the cultural dependence on the developed countries. So they want all a notion of development that doesn't fit in our country, like air conditioning, air tightness,
right?
a lot of things that's the most difficult.
That's tough. Yeah. And also, I'm thinking about the house we are working on right now, and the clients come with this idea of the house in the middle of the plot, surrounded by grass. Not like if it was like they're obsessed by that. So even if it's hard to break those images that are so anchored. They come with those type of ideas, and they come with a lot of images, you know, from Instagram.
Right. So Pinterest.
So yeah, Pinterest or so. That's I think the toughest. Sometimes we feel like psychologists, or because you spend a lot of time talking and coming back again because they come back again. So no, I'm. Still want these and those are images that doesn't have sense or
Are those images things that exist in Peru, or are they aspirations outside of Peru that they want to have?
Yeah, it's
coming from the US.
Yes.
It's coming from Europe.
That's a problem.
Do you think what you're doing when you do that, are you uncovering what you want or what you think they really want subconsciously but maybe don't know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the strength of some of these buildings or houses or whatever comes from what they are
dreaming of.
Mm-hmm. But they don't know they are dreaming about those things. So they, for us, the best way to do that is when they are convinced that they had that idea. No, so they are authors as we are in their way of living, and there are some houses where a strong party was made by what they really wanted.
A conversation with them,
You mentioned in your Q&A with Oliver after your talk about the constraint, I guess, of the construction industry in Peru, but also you talked about using that construction process in your own small way, as you acknowledged, to try and decolonize some of the colonial construct you find yourselves in. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the way the construction industry works with architecture in Peru and the limitations or opportunities that places on you, how it shapes your architecture and where decolonization fits into that.
One thing that is very important to know is that architects are not responsible of the site works. So we are responsible of our drawings, and when it's built, is the responsibility of the contractor.
So you can lose control in that process.
There's a big problem because we don't have control over the site work, but it's also an opportunity because we don't have the power. And because we don't have the power, we can say things and gain trust easily because we're not people of power. Mm-hmm. No, we're not powerful. but we can be persuasive. Mm-hmm. So two things. First, convincing the client that we should be in the site work and helping him. And the other, on the other hand, we are not perceived as by the workers, by the labor, as against them or controlling them. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we begin a conversation. And from this conversation with these people, we establish a dialogue on ways to do it better, cheaper, because mm-hmm. drawings not necessarily are not mandatory in this process.
Mm-hmm. So you mean the builders are not just receiving orders, they become your collaborators.
Yes. So mm-hmm. always the key will be in this relation with directly with the people that are on site, and making easy that we are at their also disposal to go and see if there's something that they want to change, that we can go and see if we can find a solution together, like a partnership. And of course the client must agree, but so it's important to be on site also. Yeah. We like to be on site.
Yeah, but because we don't have power, we can be equal. Yeah. So the conversations are open, are not hierarchical.
Yeah.
And how does that fit into decolonization?
We just ended with this idea by chance, because in this way of building that is handmade, we found that imperfection could be an asset. And why an asset? Because imperfection is related to handcrafting, is not industrial, and we leave traces, or people leave traces. So if you tell the masons to do or to do in some way after a conversation, the traces that you will see, or the way that they put the stone or whatever, they are participating in it. So they are not anymore invisible, but they there's like a presence of the absence. They are not anymore there when the building is completed, but you can see and perceive their own work. No? And you can see maybe there are errors or stains or whatever, mm-hmm. but it's telling a story, the story of building.
And it's unique to that building, and it's a character.
Exactly.
Yes. And it's unique to that place and those materials.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah.
So this is what you meant when you were talking today about the process not finishing when the construction drawings are done.
Exactly. Yes.
And
yes,
about
yes.
this being layering more memory onto the building and the place.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah.
Like the process is like building a map, no, of these traces, and at the end the map will talk about this process, no? Like it's a memory of the process.
And decolonization is about breaking this hierarchy where the architect, the engineer are the doers, and the others are the executors.
Yeah.
No? So it's a way of breaking this thing, and we try to establish, because we don't have power, we try to establish this new relationship between the different actors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And listening, because they have their own knowledge, and they have, as I was saying, they have a tradition of building with concrete, with bricks, and they work with so much care. Even it's not perfect, but I appreciate a lot, like this care that they put on their work. So that's also part of what we embrace in these projects in Peru. No?
Is this what you mean by when you moved from Paris to Lima, constraints that are creative versus constraints that are not creative?
Exactly.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. Right.
Because it's sort of, I think I get it from what I saw today. Yeah. It's sort of often in interviews it reads like, well, there's less building regulations. And that would be great because we'd all love to not do that. But I understand more clearly now that collaboration with the act of making, it's very manual. Three hands-on, and you've talked about in your work drawing and model making. That's how has that changed over 30 years, and especially as more and more technology is coming into the workplace, particularly through graduates. Mm-hmm. You know, the graduates are coming in with extremely high digital skills, at least here. I don't know how they're educated and what's prioritized. Yeah. How's that changed over time?
We started drawing by hand in university without any computers. Then in Paris we start getting used to working in with ArchiCAD and but still keeping drawing by hand, keeping modeling by hand. And at some stage, I think in more or less 2010, we start studies in a master studies in landscape and territory, and at that point, like we decided it was too much to continue to draw by computer maybe by chance because we didn't have enough time, but I think it was very important to stop for us to stop and computer, and so we are since then we are only by hand, and then we work a lot very closely with people in the team, and they are all doing all by computer. So
And by hand is not necessarily only sketches. No, we have technical drawing by hand.
You said today what you called a circular dynamic between mind, hand, and matter, which I love because you know I also believe that there's something different happens when you're using your hands to make space or fold than when you're doing it with a mouse. Yeah. So you dabbled with the computer, but you've returned back.
Yeah,
that's working for you.
Yeah, because you
lose a relation with the scale also. No?
Yeah, and you conquer time because it's slower.
Yeah.
The drawing something gets more time. While drawing, you're always thinking. So you give yourself time to realize what you're drawing.
Yeah, it's like another dimension. Yeah. And that that happens also when we arrived to Europe, and we felt that we didn't knew anything because when we studied in Peru, we didn't had access to books and all of that. It was a difficult period, and when we arrived to Europe, we felt like kind of ignorance. We didn't have like architectural culture. So we started to move to visit buildings, sites, landscapes, and then draw, and by the drawing, like you were learning. And but the thing is that by drawing you take time in observation, because if not, a photo is a second, no? But drawing you will stay there 20 minutes, 30 minutes. And so time is precious. So when you spend time in drawing the projects or try rethinking the project also, when you like time is precious.
Yeah.
So in this process of doing by hand, time is an ally. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the ramps. slowing down.
Yes.
I know we'll be wanting to get to the next talk. Sandra, you were awarded the AJAR Woman Architect of the Year in 2018. What's the status of women in architecture in Peru as a scene? And are there other female architects that our listeners might like to look into and see their work that deserve recognition?
Yes, when I was studying, we were few women, but now we are teaching, and it has changed a lot. It's like I have 3/4 of the classroom are women, and so I think conditions has changed a lot, and women are in many different work type of working around architecture, no? Like even in construction sites and supervisions and designers so from my generation there are few architects, women architects that has been recognized in Peru. But I think now it will new generation will be like stronger and stronger. No, the prize was with the Paracas Museum. I think it was an important recognition even for Peru, because we don't have those type of recognitions. I felt. Was important for me, and now I'm like, I think it's as teacher, I like to be in the academia also, because you're kind of a model for all these women students, and
Jean-Pierre, thank you so much for making time to talk for us today. We loved hearing your talk. I'm sure our listeners will enjoy listening to our chat with you today. Best of luck for the rest of your time. Safe diving. hope you enjoy what you see. And thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.